Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on June 19, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Maghavabhanga Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha gives a detailed analysis of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So as I said earlier, the name of the sutta is the Maghavabhanga Sutta. Vibhanga means analysis. Magga is another word for suffering, so it's the analysis of suffering. But what the sutta is about, it's an analysis of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Like everything the Buddha taught, he taught in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths, which was his first teaching. We had a little discussion on retreat about using the word superior or inferior suttas, and it was suggested that I find a better phrase than that, maybe primary and secondary. And this would be a hard one to classify as not primary, although it's not. It's referenced in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, but this sutta describes the only path the Buddha ever taught toward awakening. It's an analysis of his Eightfold Path. And it also points to the difficulties that have occurred in adapting or accommodating or embellishing that Eightfold Path in any way. And so a lot of the additions, as they were applied and became part of a Dharma practice, seemed reasonable. They seemed somehow leading to the goal. But the goal had changed at that point, and so it no longer was a path leading to the cessation of suffering. It was actually the adaptations, accommodations, and embellishment created a path that led away from becoming awakened and led towards continued ignorance simply because it masked the path. And this is a very simple and direct path that the Buddha taught. Here's the sutta, the Maghavabhanga Sutta. I have heard that at one time the Buddha was staying at Savatthi at Jita's Grove, Anatha Pandika's monastery. He addressed those assembled. Friends, I will now give you a detailed analysis of the Noble Eightfold Path. Listen mindfully. This is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And then the Buddha describes very clearly what those are. And what is right what is right view? Right view is knowledge with regard to stress. Right view is knowledge with regard to the origination of stress. Right view is knowledge with regard to the stopping or the cessation of stress. And right view is knowledge with regard to the way of practice leading to the stopping or the cessation of stress, meaning the Eightfold Path. Each one of those aspects of right view relates directly to one of the Four Noble Truths. And then he concludes that simple statement by saying, this is right view, very clear and direct. And what is right intention? Right intention is being mindful of the intention to recognize and abandon wrong views. It follows his description of right view. It makes sense that right intention would be that way. Right intention is being mindful of the intention to remain free from ill will. Right intention is having the intention to be mindful of the intention to remain harmless to all beings. Notice these first two aspects of the Eightfold Path. Anybody could do this, right? There's nothing beyond a human capabilities to do these things. Notice that there's nothing mystical or magical. There's nothing that's rooted in any other way of developing it except our own direct experience through this path. This, friends, is called right intention.
Could you give me those last two?
Well, I'll read all three of them. What is right intention? Being mindful of the intention to recognize and abandon wrong views. Now, of course, that's a very broad statement too, but it's also very simple and direct. The point of the Eightfold Path is to hold the intention to recognize and abandon wrong views. Wrong views rooted in ignorance. Wrong views are views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Being mindful of the intention to remain free from ill will. And that's not only outwardly focused. In fact, more importantly, it's inwardly focused. Ill will towards ourselves, to hold harsh judgments of ourselves. And then being mindful of the intention to remain harmless to all beings. Kind of like the same, it follows from not holding ill will towards others is to not be harmless. And it, the profound nature of those simple directions cannot be overlooked. All of us as human beings want to remain harmless to other people, don't we? But yet sometimes we're not able to. Why? Because we have aspects of mindlessness at times. And so the Eightfold Path is simply a reminder to be a human being, but to be an awakened, fully mature human being. Again, it's nothing extraordinary in its teachings, but it is extraordinary in its development, isn't it? Much like meditation, much like the description of the jhanas that follow. Was that cover what you wanted?
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha concludes, this, friends, is right intention. And what is right speech? Abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from abusive speech, abstaining from gossip, and abstaining from idle chatter. Again, anyone can do this. And if you look at how our minds are when we indulge in wrong speech rather than engage in right speech, you can see how it leaves our minds disturbed and confused and always justifying itself. Simple and direct teaching that anyone can develop as long as we don't adapt it, accommodate it, or embellish it in any way. When, why would we? Here's simple and direct teachings. And what is right action? Abstaining from taking life, abstaining from taking what is not freely given, abstaining from sexual misconduct. This, friends, is right action. And what is right livelihood? Right livelihood abandons dishonest livelihood. Right livelihood is honest livelihood. Can't be any more direct than that. I know when I first came across the Eightfold Path and read right speech, right action, and then I read right livelihood, and I was, doesn't right speech and right action cover right livelihood? Why is there another, why is this part of the path and not just covered by those first two? Until I realized that even during the Buddha's times, otherwise good and honest people would make exceptions to their goodness and their honesty when they're putting food on the table, taking care of their family. And even in that way, probably more so today than then, we need to recognize that. There's no justification for wrong speech or wrong. Pardon me?
No justification for mafia meatballs.
No justification for making meatballs, yes. That was two very distant relatives. That it was, and it was a rumor. There were folks up in Amsterdam. They were Taruch's kids. And I'll tell you about Taruch one day. But I hope my aunt isn't listening to this. She cries when I do. Taruch lived to 112 years old. A remarkable man, he really was. He was the patriarch of my mother's side, and he was good to go right up to the end. I mean,
was he happy?
He was happy. Well, he was happy because he learned at a very early age to make some very strong wine, and he kept making it right till the day he died. And that was right effort. No, and what? And what is right effort? Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to avoid unskillful qualities that are not present. Is that confusing?
Yeah.
I will. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to avoid unskillful qualities that are not present. So what are unskillful qualities that are not present? Those qualities that are related to speech, action, and livelihood. It's very clear. If they're not, what the instruction here is that if we're not manifesting those in the present moment, to be mindful of that and don't grasp after something that would have them arise. It's simply saying, be careful. Be careful how you think, be careful how you act. To avoid falling into something that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to abandon unskillful qualities that are present. Meaning recognize when you're engaged in the wrong aspects of behavior, simply be mindful of it and abandon them. Right effort is effort developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to establish skillful qualities that are not yet present. What skillful qualities? Right view, right intention, right, etc. Develop the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha is teaching us very directly, if we're going to develop the Eightfold Path, we need to integrate it and be mindful of it as the framework for our developing awakening. Be mindful when we're not in the framework of the Eightfold Path and abandon that type of behavior, but as importantly, to be mindful when we are engaged in behavior that is within the framework of the Eightfold Path. Again, just to simplify that, the Buddha taught that it was as important to be mindful of what's occurring, to be mindful of what's present, as it is to be mindful of what's not present. To know that we're developing the Eightfold Path. We are no longer competitive or aggressive or mean or dishonest or et cetera, et cetera. It's to be mindful of that. Why? Because now we know that we're developing the Eightfold Path, and as important to be mindful when we are engaging in the behavior that is part of the framework of the Eightfold Path. Is that clear? Right effort is effort in developing the skillful desire and ongoing persistence to end confusion and increase the full development of skillful qualities that are present. Clear? To be mindful that we are developing the Eightfold Path and to keep our focus on continuing to develop that to its fruition, to its complete development. We're building practical knowledge of right behavior, to use that in a very broad sense. We're going from behavior that is at times rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths to behavior that is rooted in the wisdom of an Eightfold Path, the wisdom of an awakened human being. These are his teachings. This is what he taught. And again, he didn't teach it in any mystical or magical way. It's not given to us from a supreme being or a grand spiritual system. It's developed right within, as the Buddha talked about, developing that right within. Self-awakening is what the Buddha declared that we're doing here. This, friends, is right effort. And what is right mindfulness? Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the body, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. That's the same instructions that are given in the Satipatthana Sutta, in the Anapanasati Sutta. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of feelings arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. Maintaining a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring. Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of mental qualities arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to worldly events. This relates directly to the meditation instruction too, doesn't it? Right mindfulness is remaining mindful of the quality of mind arising and passing away, free of distraction, ardent, alert, and mindful of abandoning greed and reaction to relate to worldly events. That last sequence relates directly to the four foundations of mindfulness, doesn't it? And that last direction is to be mindful of the ever-changing quality of our mind, no matter what it is. I say that often to shorten it a little bit, is to be at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. That's kind of the essence of a person engaged in Dhamma practice, to understand that we're moving from experiences rooted in ignorance of the way things are to experience in life rooted in wisdom of the way, or an understanding of the way things are. Along the way, the Buddha's teaching us here, and I hope I'm teaching it too, is to be mindful of graduating towards that and eliminating those things that no longer serve us if we want to awaken. If we don't want to awaken, if we're not interested in developing full human maturity, then there'll be an awful lot of resistance to this, wouldn't there be? We don't want to hear it, because it's not something that we can readily engage in. But if we want to engage in it, if we want to develop full human maturity, these are the most profound and direct teachings that we've ever been given, and they're still work today. And what is right meditation? The Buddha concludes that with saying, and this, friends, is right mindfulness. So if you're ever concerned or not clear about what you should be holding in mind, you can just relate, look back at the sutta and you'll know what you need to hold in mind, the Eightfold Path. And this description of right meditation relates to the Buddha's description of the jhanas, which are often portrayed today as these levels of meditation that are far beyond most normal human beings. And of course, the jhanas are simply the Buddha's description of ordinary but very profound levels of meditative absorption that all of us develop and most of us experience in every meditation session, even if it's just for a brief moment. And what is right meditation? For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases. Initially, the first thing the Buddha teaches is meditation is for deepening concentration. Their meditation increases, and they withdraw from the need for sensual stimulation. What is that? That engaging in meditation in that appropriate way, not doing anything else, not grasping after visualizations or counting as that comes up, or trying to contact our disincarnate teachings. That, none of that deepens concentration, does it? That deepens concentration. That's why the Buddha taught that in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, to begin that process by being mindful of the breath in the body. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they withdraw from unskillful mental qualities. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and they enter and remain in the first jhana, which is the first level of meditative absorption. Joyful engagement and pleasure in the Dhamma, born from withdrawal and accompanied by directed thought and mindful evaluation. Just means we're feeling good about developing concentration. For one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases and their directed thoughts and mindful evaluation quiets. So initially we're engaged in meditation and we are quieting our minds by being mindful of our breath, but we're still being drawn back into our thoughts and then coming back to our breath. Now the Buddha is teaching us, as our concentration increases just a little bit, we're gaining control of our thinking. We're gaining the ability to think what we want to think, when we want to think it, even if it's just momentarily. That's the first jhana and the second jhana. We're deepening, jhana means levels of meditative absorption. So in a very direct way, we are experiencing what the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago. They enter and remain in the second jhana, the second level of meditative absorption, which is joyful engagement and pleasure born of deepening concentration, free from directed thought and mindful evaluation, and confident within. In other words, as we're developing this slightly deeper level of concentration, we realize that it's a pleasant abiding. And we recognize the deepening level of concentration. Often that's just experienced in early meditation and even for people that have been meditating for many, many years as it just feels good. That's the second level. And again, it might not last for very long. It might last for longer. But it's just an acknowledgement that now my mind is calming. I'm developing a measure of peace and I do not have to be concerned with my thoughts. My thoughts are simply flowing. Lorna described that. It was probably a couple of years ago now, is that, you remember, you know what I'm going to say? Mm-hmm. It was a great description. She said, I feel like my thoughts are down here and my breath is up here. So thoughts, we're human beings. That's why I give that instructions. We're conscious beings. Thoughts flow. They have to. The purpose of meditation is to not be distracted by those thoughts flowing. We're no longer grasping after thoughts. What?
I still can't do it.
You are doing it. You described it 2 years ago. Maybe more.
I get caught up in my thoughts.
Well, we all do, but but you're experiencing the second level of meditative absorption. That's really
the
point of what the Buddha
is. Rising and the passing.
Yeah.
Rising and the passing.
And this teaching is really.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. This is 2,600 years ago. The Buddha was teaching this 2,600 years ago to demystify all the. Well, be careful with the word I use. Contradictory meditation practices that were present then. And those words are still useful today, aren't they? He's telling us, in essence, keep this very simple, and the results will be right there. You don't need to embellish it. Engage in the simple practice, and you will enter into the first jhana, the second jhana, and for one who has developed right meditation, their concentration increases, and the joyful engagement fades. Equanimity arises with mindfulness of pleasure in the mind united with the body. What a powerful, powerful line. And again, it points to the culmination of the Buddha's path, isn't it? A mind united in the body, not needing anything, not needing the five clinging aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, or ongoing thinking to be any different than it is. That five aggregates is a description of ongoing, personal experience of ongoing suffering. In meditation, as our concentration increases, as we deepen these levels of jhana, naturally, without grasping after anything, we're developing freedom from wrong views in a direct and visceral way. We have the experience of it. And the Buddha's pointing out here in this teaching to look at that. Notice it. Notice the thoughts here and the breath up here. Notice the thoughts just flowing and having no effect. Because that's how thoughts are supposed to act. Just like the description of how our blood is pumped through our body. We don't have to think about every heartbeat, do we? And yet the blood keeps flowing. Our thoughts should be the same way until we need to direct them. Until there's a reason to be thinking what we need to think in an appropriate way. But other than that, thoughts flow. When we're not distracted by our own thoughts, we're much more engaged in the world because our mind is united in our body. It's not objectified outside of our body. There's no opportunity for stress to occur when we are united in our body.
But surely every thought that we have is a reference to our own anatta. Hmm. So when we're not taking any notice of our thoughts and our thoughts are flowing, we are still connecting with our own anatta because all our thoughts are directed that way.
Yes, as we're developing the path.
Yes.
And so notice that this instruction is instruction on right meditation, what we do during meditation. And then it's off our cushion that we feel the effects of this. Right meditation is to notice going through these different levels of meditative absorption. And of course we're doing it because we are stuck in self-referential views. Is that
yes,
clarified?
But surely the work we do on the cushion, actually meditating, is a more concentrated version of what actually happens in real life.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So if we are having flowing thoughts, which are referential thoughts, that's okay, as long as we don't connect with them.
As long as we, yes. Even those thoughts in fact, I would say that's developing awareness of the abandonment of those thoughts by simply letting them be.
The virtue factors kind of having the guardrails of, are you on this path?
Yes, that's,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, because you have these thoughts, people have thoughts.
Yeah.
But is it framed within these precepts and factors? And that
where the thoughts go into action.
Yeah, but
that's where you need the
present moment,
yeah,
unfolding. Is it wholesome or is it not?
Yeah.
It's a basic, it's one or the other.
Yeah. It's basic logic, it's basic morality, it's basic ethics. And the reason why the framework of the Eightfold Path is there is so we don't excuse it away,
mm-hmm,
which is another way of saying ignore our own ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm acting in any type of wrong behavior, unskillful behavior, it's because my mind is rooted in ignorance of the way things really are. Because a mind that's not rooted in ignorance of the way things are, a mind that's rooted in wisdom of Four Noble Truths, simply doesn't act or think that way. That mind is a liberated mind. It's what a lot of us experience on retreat. That I was just thinking about, there's a picture of Becky, if you haven't seen it, with her. She's walking down the middleway path and her hands are up. I think I put the label liberated because it just exemplifies that, doesn't it? We're free. We're free of what? We're not free of something that's imposed on us. We're free of our own ignorance. There's a reason for joy there, isn't there? And there's also a reason for acknowledgement of my own efforts, meaning as an individual is developing the path. The Buddha is pointing that out, how important it is to acknowledge growing towards awakening, growing towards full human maturity. Great discussion. Equanimity arises with mindfulness of pleasure in a mind united with the body. They enter the third jhana. The wise know this as equanimous and mindful, a pleasant abiding. Equanimity is a mind that is simply balanced. It's equal. No matter what's occurring, its response is equal. It's neither good nor bad. It's neither agitating or escaping. You know, a lot of times we escape from what's occurring because it makes us feel good. Some people do it with drugs and alcohol, food, golf, work, could be anything. Just because it makes us feel good doesn't mean that it's leading towards the culmination. It's usually just something else rooted in ignorance, unless it's framed by the Eightfold Path. So the action of, as the Buddha is describing meditation within this framework, directly confronts our own ignorance. If we're willing to do it, this is where where great gentleness but great courage is necessary. Because we have to be willing to look at our own fabrications and where they're taking us in order to abandon them, rather than justify our feelings by using something that allows us to do that, such as insisting that everything must be positive. That's the probably the most powerful underlying way of ignoring ignorance. Everything is, I can't look at anything negative. Well, the Buddha taught, I would say this often, via negativa. He taught that we must look at the negative, the so-called negative, if we're going to abandon it. How else would it happen, pardon me?
Fourth foundation.
Exactly. Look at it. Don't be afraid of it. The Buddha started his whole dispensation by saying negativity occurs, dukkha occurs, as a consequence of having a human life. There it is. Don't run from it anymore. Don't ignore it because you're ignoring your own ignorance. But consequently, don't embrace it. It's not something to be embraced, which is, you know, people, in some of the teachings, we should embrace our suffering. We're not supposed to do anything with it except recognize it and know where it comes from. It comes from ignorance. Pardon me?
It feels like I'm juggling a bunch of balls sometimes because when I experience a jhana or two, I just love meditation and I'll keep doing it, and then all of a sudden I'll bam into this wall of my mental fabrications and the stuff that I don't like, and my mind will be buzzing, and I'm thinking, what happened? What happened to all the peace and stuff like that? And I just kind of want to crave and cling to what was, and when that doesn't work, I just have to, okay, everything's impermanent, be gentle with myself, it doesn't, you know, I'm not going to always have an absolutely perfect meditation, and I feel like I've grown up a little bit when I say that to myself, and, but I have to go through all this nanny-nanny hissy fits, you know, tantrum stuff before I get to the mature.
Yeah. Let me go back that one. Their mind rests in equanimity, neither pleasure nor pain have a footing. And again, the Buddha's not talking about a permanent state until it's a permanent state. He's talking about what happens in meditation. We develop a mind resting in equanimity because in that moment, neither pleasure nor pain, grasping after things, does not have a footing. Where? It doesn't have a footing in our mind or in our body. In that moment. Of course, the next thought of that piece of chocolate cake that's in the back of the refrigerator comes up, and there it is again. But what do? I recognize that my mind is no longer equanimous. I recognize the object that's taking me out of it, the objectification of my own thoughts. And I'm using chocolate cake. It could be anything. It could be, you know, the work I need to do tomorrow, or anything else, the argument I had earlier, whatever's taking me out of my present moment. I'm no longer equanimous. What do? Take a breath. Every one of us in this room has talked about the value of just of being caught up in a stressful situation and remember to take a couple of breaths and how it brings you back into a calm, right? Everyone? Is there anyone that hasn't had that experience? That's what the Buddha's talking about. And so in that moment, you're experiencing, whether it's on your cushion or not, in that moment, you're experiencing the third jhana. Again, it's nothing extraordinary. It's not superhuman. It's entirely ordinary, even though it's such a profound experience. Neither pleasure nor pain have a footing. They enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Their mindfulness and equanimity is pure, free of wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This, monks, is right meditation. I'll finish it. This is what the Buddha declared. Those gathered were gratified and delighted at his words. That's the end of the sutta. And my, if you read the article, you didn't hear this, you didn't read this part because I just put it in today because I realized I needed more reference. The Buddha's description of right meditation is a description of the jhanas. Jhanas are ever-increasing levels of meditative absorption. and they are often portrayed as extraordinary, almost mystical levels that are achieved by only a few. As seen here, the jhanas are ordinary, though profound levels of meditative absorption developed by any meditator engaging in shamatha vipassana meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path. So that may seem like an almost obscure thing to point out, but it is one of the most important. I'm talking about the jhanas now. The Buddha talked about these different levels of meditation absorption frequently in many different sutras, the Samadhi Sutta and many others, to place the importance of it, but also to teach the ordinariness of it. So there's a subtle desire that often is present in meditation practice. When I first started meditating, I thought that I was going to be able to have out-of-body experiences and transmigrate my soul to the other side of Pluto and live for millions and millions a year and do all these kind of things to be clairvoyant. My intention back then was to escape something that I felt was broken, that wasn't worthwhile to have me in it, which was me, my life. I was using meditation to escape what was there. And the early meditation techniques that I developed helped me feel like I was doing that, like I was achieving something. But what was I doing? I found a so-called spiritual way of justifying being out of my body continually. But it felt good. But slowly, the confusion and the lack of sustenance there was gnawing at me. And I didn't realize what was wrong with my practice until I read words like this from the Buddha. And then I realized that meditation wasn't something to use as an escape from who I was. It was a path directly leading to what I am, which is in an ongoing process of becoming. Hence the name of the book, Becoming Buddha. And so when you understand yourself in relation to the Buddha's teachings in right view, then you see yourself as someone developing what a Buddha taught, to awaken, to develop full human maturity, which is nothing ordinary but very profound. And it's important, as the Buddha's pointing out, to use the title of the sutta is the analysis of suffering or the analysis of the path, to apply that analysis to our own minds and what's occurring. That's really what the Buddha's teaching here. And as important, to recognize the ever-deepening levels of meditative absorption that we all develop. That's tonight's teaching. Thank you. Hope you found it useful. Any questions about the sutta? Frank?
Did you ever teach that, the sutta?
No.
Yeah, found it interesting.
Yeah, I haven't consciously not taught it. It's actually something that I wrote mostly, maybe 2 or 3 years ago. But I'm always talking about it. One of the reason why I taught it now is I realize that I haven't taught this sutta, and it's time to just kind of put it on the record. But it's an important sutta, isn't it?
I found it very descriptive of the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And helpful.
Yeah, I mean, it's right up there with the primary suttas, the Buddha's first three teachings of dependent origination. Because again, it's an awakened human being saying, this is what you do. This is my path. And it, I think he describes it in a way that's really accessible. Is that,
mm-hmm.
would anybody say it's not? That it's obscure or vague?
No, but I find that as I get further down the path, I feel myself getting pulled further from the origination of stress and understanding right view. Like right view for me, understanding stress, the origination of stress, and to, for me, it is a fruition of that understanding, my own origination of stress. And it's like that moment where you have clarity and all the path just kind of unfolds in front of you from right view, and the understanding is there. maturity.
Yeah, it is just that. It's just a, it's a great description. That's how the Buddha describes awakened right view. And so as the from beginning right view, it's simply an acknowledgement that I don't have it yet. How do I develop it? Here's the path to do it. Here's the path to go from wrong view, views ignorance of four noble, ignorant of four noble truths, to a wise human being, a person who understands who they are in relation to the world. And that's reference to the three marks of existence, which is what the Buddha taught. This is, we gain insight into these three marks of existence. Thank you, Frank. Let's go around the room. Good to see you, Ron.
Hmm. So at this point, if somebody asks you, how does this stuff work? You're pointing to this sutta.
Yeah.
Since here is the, I kept waiting for, you know, it's kind of a silly thought, like, where's the big secret here?
There is.
It just isn't. He just lays it all out nicely, logically, and with, you know, bite-sized things.
Yeah.
This is how it works. It's, yeah, I would say this is a primary sutra.
Oh, I can use that word again. Yeah, I, and maybe I should apologize for not teaching it sooner. I mean, like maybe the other, there's a lot of descriptions of the Eightfold Path, but you're right. This breaks it down into bite-sized pieces that we can readily develop. But there's also a lot here.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
This
yeah,
is
yeah, yeah. Every part of it again can be expanded on to.
Yeah.
It's almost like a good base for the truth of happiness.
It is
the way it's organized.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I agree. So they're now I have to rewrite that. But, no, it is, and it will be included in the revised Becoming Buddha, and I probably will put it in that.
First or second tone.
But it's when I started developing the Buddha's teachings, I was still very confused, which led to even to still complicating, making things much more complicated than they needed to be. And it really wasn't until I got, you know, there's a word, if anybody used to read, Robert Heinlein? Stranger in a Strange Land, grok. What a great word, because it, grok, anybody else know what that means? Grok, G-R-O-K? It's a word that Robert Heinlein used in this particular, I think he used it in another book too, but I can't remember.
Yeah.
It was like a grok means a profound
grasping
understanding, but also almost in a physically engaged way too,
mm-hmm.
of understanding. So I finally grokked what this was all about when I understood this. When I understood this is what the Buddha taught, and I can still remember this. I could do this, and that was the greatest revelation in my life, I think, because up until that point, at least the way that I perceived it, maybe not the way it was taught to me, but that the way that I took it in was that this was always something beyond me, and it would take forever to develop it, and I would need special gifts and all kinds of things. None of it made sense. But when I read this, I realized that that wasn't what he was about. He was about helping human beings reach their full potential in a peaceful way, in a way that leaves their mind equanimous. What a remarkable thing, isn't it? And what's most remarkable is it works. Lorna, sorry for the long winded.
Well, I want to thank you very much for the sutta. It was very clear. I enjoyed it very much. But I've kind of asked my questions along the way tonight, so I don't have much more to add. Thank you.
Thank you. David, good evening.
Good evening. It's the way it's listed almost doesn't give the full impact of the Eightfold Path, because you almost have to have a leap of faith in the first two, this wisdom, and it's only when you get to the anchor of the concentration factors of mindfulness that you can kind of go along with the right effort until you develop that mindfulness to refine that concentration, so then you can become more wise.
Yeah.
And
it just, it's a simplicity and elegance to it all.
Yeah.
So it's almost like this linear thinking about it doesn't do it justice.
Yeah, and that, again, wow.
Because you end up going back to, you work toward the right view. You start off with right view, okay, yeah, I understand that. But until you develop that concentration, you don't know anything. You don't know anything.
And if you didn't have the framework of the Eightfold Path, you'd never be able to develop the Eightfold Path. I mean, that sounds kind of silly to say.
It's like,
but
while you're learning, do these things in the middle. Just try not to hurt anyone.
Yeah.
Try not to, you know, do these things until you figure out the other stuff. And then you can be wise.
Yeah. It's almost like the Buddha saying, do this because it'll make you feel good until you
right,
really get it.
Kind of like it's almost
yeah.
like an umbrella of everything.
Yeah. And what did... I don't know that I've ever looked at it that way, but what a brilliant way to see it. And it just, it reinforces my appreciation and respect for what a human being did. The brilliance of to be able to see that.
He keeps on talking about mindfulness. Mindfulness, it's a factor. It's a.
But a specific, refined mindfulness.
Yeah.
But
it's this anchor to this last, you know, these concentration factors.
Yeah. Yeah. Appropriate mindfulness. Even the scribe uses that word in his description of his own awakening. And remember, the spiritual milieu was the same then that it is now. The Buddha was exposed and studied and was impacted by all those different spiritual systems, and he realized those are fine, but I want to understand the nature of suffering. This is an analysis of suffering, and this is an analysis of the path. Brilliant way of saying that, so thank you. Mary, good evening.
Good evening. I enjoyed the sutta. It's funny, often I'm feeling like I'm hearing something for the first time, but this time I was hearing something for the first time. But I felt like I heard it 1,000 times before. So that was an unusual experience.
Almost deja vu.
In a twisted way. That's certainly reinforcing the simplicity and the elegance that is the Eightfold Path and the wandering, you know, way that you experience it. I don't have anything to say. It's just so, it's all said, it's all there. And, you know, I try to bring joyful engagement to this process and to the practice so that I'm experiencing, as I get further on the path, that I continue to experience things off the cushion that sometimes you don't even realize till the end of the day and you're thinking about it and you see the validation of your thinking or your effort or your behavior, you know, in situations. David and I have talked a lot about really taking time to identify what's not there,
yeah.
you know, and when you've been with someone for a long time, there's a lot of things that can be repetitive or are always there that are helpful or not helpful or whatever. And, you know, so we've really enjoyed talking about things or being in situations or after situations and recognizing what's no longer there.
Yeah.
It's also joyful. You know, so it's its own reward. It's its own on your path to, like David saying, you go back and, you know, and there's more wisdom as you will have to start your day again, you know.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you. Helen, good to see you this evening.
Thank you. Good to be here. I've been thinking about my evolution of meditation process and what Lauren was talking about before, too, and the different jhana levels. And I remember the point at which in my meditation I actually began observing the rising and the passing of thoughts, not just, oh, where did that thought come from? And what was I thinking about before it? You know, how did that connect with something else? And so now I'm at the point where I, you know, as the thoughts flow, I'm recognizing the rising and the passing of them. And just like the cloud image that Lorna also brought into our group, you know, just watching them pass and not necessarily trying to analyze why that cloud came and this one left and what does that mean and is that a storm or is that,
mm-hmm.
you know, just letting them all flow through and just sort of like observing a stream and leaves flying, floating down it and just that peaceful feeling that comes with that.
Thank you. You're describing a mind that doesn't need things to be any different than they are. And that visual of leaves flowing down, they don't need to be any different than they are. They just are. Thank you. Greg, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you. Very well. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thank you.
Always good to hear the Eightfold Path and be reminded. Because for a long time, you know, I had a general idea of focus on breath. And did it for a while, but it wasn't until I really, you know, committed to path and picking it apart and auditing and actually walking this path. Or am I just kind of, you know, focusing on my breath? Which, you know, it doesn't hurt, it's always good, but I didn't have that, the context that really, you know, coming here has really put everything in much greater context. And like, what came up earlier, how each piece could be really analyzed much farther. I was very curious, and I'm sure it's come up before, but specifically when the mention of, you know, not like killing and doing harm, is there a sutta where the Buddha specifically addresses what, like the appropriate use of violence, whether it be self-defense or the defense of others?
There is, and the context also is important too. So the Buddha would killing that's rooted in self-reference, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is what the Buddha is talking about. And that's often extrapolated to mean we shouldn't even step on a bug or anything like that. And the Buddha never, that is an extreme view. The Buddha also advised leaders at the time who were going into battle. And he didn't put up his hand and say, you can't do that. Because he knew that that was impractical. Mm-hmm. But what he did teach leaders is that when you conquer the next town, you treat those people with respect. You take care of their needs. You don't, in other words, you don't, even at that time, it was common to enslave people. If you're going to take over something, if you're going to use violence to get to, if you're going to use unavoidable violence, when you're done, you engage in the Eightfold Path, you take care of the people, treat them well. So the Buddha was very practical. He knew that making a blanket statement saying you never kill anything was simply impractical. It would be was Pollyannish to think that you could say that and that would just be the law of the land. Of course, all of us would say, well, yeah, we should never kill anything. But like today, it's impractical to say that that's going to, just by me saying it, that that's going to take place. So within the framework of the Eightfold Path, as an individual developing the path, I need to look at the violence within me and to remain free of killing. Now, another aspect of killing, when you take it within the framework of the Eightfold Path, would be character assassination, wouldn't it? Which is mentioned in Right Speech as gossip. We, you know, it gets to that very subtle level. There were even during the Buddha's times, monks and, I was going to say monks and nuns, but I never read a story about a nun doing this. Monks would take this too far and say that well, that means that we should never eat an animal. And there's a few stories where monks would come back in on their alms rounds and they would, guess what, Buddha? That so-and-so wanted to give me a piece of lamb and I wouldn't take it. And the Buddha admonished them. Said, you're hurting yourself and you're hurting those people. They gave you the few little bits of food that they had to nourish you and then to get a little Dhamma teaching. So again, we can't take that one statement and make an extreme view. It has to be within the framework of the Eightfold Path. So thank you for the question. the idea of ahimsa, which is complete nonviolence, is something that was rooted in the Vedas and the Upanishads, which is something that the Buddha studied, mastered, and dismissed as not leading to the goal, simply because it's unrealistic. Now, of course, an awakened human being doesn't want any other human being to suffer, but it also has to be realistic. It has to be something that human beings can develop. So we all develop that in our own way, don't we?
He does speak a little bit about it in the simile of the two-handed saw.
Yeah.
Where, he gives his whole litany of monks going out and first of all getting harangued by the locals, and then I think it's a disciple who responds to it. So Buddha said,
yeah,
what would you do if the town folks would speak badly about you?
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, I'd be grateful that they're actually not throwing stones at me.
Yeah.
And the Buddha said, okay, so now if they would be throwing stones at you, well, I said, I'm grateful that they're not actually killing me. And it goes on and on,
yep,
to the point where he actually does get killed, and he still finds his gratitude there.
Mm. Yeah. The teachings are entirely practical in how we live in the world. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Diane.
I'm just very grateful. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the teaching. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Glad you're here. Bonnie, how are you tonight?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thank you for the sutta. I love the Eightfold Path. I see it as just many layers. So it's like you walk around the block once and you get it. See all of the view, the intention, the speed. And you do it again. It's like you keep sort of, to me, you keep revisiting it. And that even though we learn it linearly, it really functions like sort of like a machine or an orchestra or something. That because if you're looking at one thing, the other thing pops up, something else, in order to help you practice that one aspect, right? So, and for me, it always goes back to the view, which is the most important, because without that, you can't see where you're walking, too.
Yeah.
So one of the things you talked about when I first came, it's sort of like being in a nautilus, and so you walk around and you integrate it. Do you remember? This was a long time ago. And it's sort of like walking that spiral and integrating it, and then you end up back at the beginning again, and but you're on a different level of understanding.
Yeah.
So sometimes I feel like I get to a place and, well, I have this thing about, I don't know if anybody watches like sci-fi films like Star Trek, or are they hyperspace, like we're here, right? So it's like in front of you is this triangle, right? And I always felt like stuff that I'm working on, one thing is on one side and one thing is on the other. And you know, you're getting closer and you're getting closer and you think you're there and you're like, you know, that point that you say, hyperspace, and you're there, but then you're back here again.
And the Klingons are after you.
So it feels like even though I make progress, I keep at it, I feel like, you know, I have to remember that you have, and you're on a different level, because otherwise it'd be like I don't know anything. I know that's not true, but, so anyway.
Thank you. That was great, especially the Star Trek. Thanks, Bonnie. Frank, good to see you. Glad you're here
tonight. I don't have much to add. I appreciate everyone's perspective on the Eightfold Path. You know, I see it as a set of tools. I think I heard someone say that tools and an instrument being played, a path of where we're already at. You know, it's not linear, it's cyclical. It's really where we're already standing. You know, it's to be practiced. It's a roadmap where we've already been, where we're going. And interestingly for me, like Bonnie said, it always comes back to right view. Because when my mind is clouded and confused, I'm usually, you said something about ill will, especially talking to yourself, like the ill will that we have towards ourselves. And Juana said something about like the thoughts, connecting to the thoughts, self-identifying with thoughts. And that's something that I do a lot lately with being ill. And kind of like being angry at myself for getting old and being old and self-identifying with this body. And I think David said something about like identifying with the self, like, or you know, with this physical being. And I mean, we can't help that we're human beings. And if I'm going to be living a life of someone who has gone forth on a spiritual path, I have a little bit more of a bite to chew than someone who's living a monastic life, because I have to live a life of someone who's entangled in the world and also live a spiritual life, which gives me plenty of opportunity to practice with stress and dukkha, so I definitely get to see my own brand and flavors of dukkha every single day, from driving to work in the morning to, you know, putting my trash out at night with my neighbor. You know, so it's like the questions that I ask myself are the most important questions that I'll answer all day long. And if I'm mindful of the view, the intention, the speech, the action, the effort, the livelihood, the mindfulness, the concentration, and the meditation, I'll be good to go.
Thank you. That's great. There'll be an announcement in Thursday's email, and I'll leave it in the subsequent newsletters. Our friend Denise Mihalik, who has an incredible voice, is going to be one of many hundreds of singers at this event in Central Park on August 11th, sponsored or commissioned by Lincoln Center. Did read about it because it's really remarkable, and maybe we'll go as a sangha. But it's all these different singers singing to different aspects of the elements of the earth in our natural environment. And I don't even quite understand. I'm not trying to explain it in a way like I understand it, but it really looks magnificent. And so just take note of it. Maybe it's something we'll do as a sangha. And Saturday's class is going to be very similar to this teaching, but it's Sariputta teaching Ananda the basics of the path, too. So you just might want to listen to it or come to class on Saturday. And I want to talk to you about maybe a date in July or August. Find a date and just that works for you and email it to me, and I'll check with Matt. And
I can give you at least one date now, and then possibly two or three more for August.
Okay. So we're talking about having a one-day retreat at this retreat house.
Trout house.
Okay, yeah, so we'll get that finalized, et cetera. And I'm going to send an email out, maybe even tomorrow, gauging interest in our fall retreat, because I got to sign a contract very quickly, and I need to be pretty sure that there's going to be 10 people attending, or I'm not going to sign the contract. So, you know, so you'll see it. I hope you get it. You know, if the thing's going to spam folder, but I need to make that decision pretty quickly. So I know some of you can't make it because of the wedding. So, please get back to me as quick as you can on that. Let's finish like we always do with the Buddha's words on metta. So again, find your relaxed meditation posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.